Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Who was Charles Darwin, and what led him to describe what we now call the theory of evolution? These curious questions are ones that I have been following since I was about 10 years old. A few years later, in 1978, I had the good fortune of visiting the Galapagos Islands, 600 miles west of Ecuador in the Pacific Ocean. Charles Darwin visited the Galapagos Islands in 1831 for a month as part of his five-year voyage around the world. There, he saw birds and animals that helped him formulate some of his ideas about evolution that he published 22 years later in 1853. And the world has not been the same since. Now, at a time when concepts of evolution and natural selection are attacked from certain theological and political perspectives, a novel called The Darwin Conspiracy has been written by John Darton, a writer and editor for the New York Times. The Darwin Conspiracy, although fiction, is said by John Darton to be 90% accurate and covers Charles Darwin's life and thinking that led to the publication of Darwin's book, The Origin of the Species, as well as a portion of Darwin's life after the publication of his book. I spoke with John Darton from his home in New York City at the end of October 2005. He begins by describing who Charles Darwin was in his time and in his place. John Darton, welcome to Radio Curious.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here, Barry.
Let's put Charles Darwin in perspective. Who was he in his period in his life, living in England?
Well, he was really one of the great scientists of all time. In fact, though, he was an amateur. He was an amateur naturalist. His father very much wanted him to be a doctor. He could not stand basically the sight of blood, so he washed out as a doctor. And throughout his growing up years, he was just attracted to the natural world. He loved to go looking for beetles and to perform various experiments, and he did that throughout his years at Cambridge. Then, just fortuitously, he got this invitation to travel on the Beagle. He leapt at it. He had some trouble, actually, getting it because his father initially opposed the trip. And then he went on this glorious five-year trip around the world, despite the fact that he was badly seasick every day on the high seas. It opened up his eyes to the world of nature in a way that I guess he could just not have anticipated. And it pushed him to start thinking. And once Darwin started thinking, he thought deeply and deeply, more deeply, and never stopped thinking. And the questions that confronted him were the questions of the age, which was, you know, is evolution a fact, and how could it have happened? He became, I guess, obsessed with this, and as we all know, came up with a resolution. What interests me in him is he's perfect specimen of his age. That is to say, he was a Victorian. He assumed the hierarchy of Victorian values were the true ones. That is, Europeans were at the top of the totem pole, and yet his scientific nature took over so that he saw a kind of equality among the species. We're on the same level as earthworms in his scheme of things.
How do you see that change in his thinking? What brought it about?
Well, certainly one moment of epiphany had to be when on the Beagle, which don't forget had three so-called savages, what the Victorians called savages on board, who had been picked up by the captain, Robert Fitzroy, in a previous trip, brought to England dressed up and civilized and then were being thrown back into their natural habitat. Anyway, when the beagle arrived at Tierra del Fuego, at the very tip of South America, he saw the Indians, and they were so primitive that they just formed this indelible impression on him. He described seeing them running along the banks, kind of foaming at the mouth, and some of them bleeding and huffing and puffing, and dressed just in the most kind of primitive loincloths made out of animal skins. And he was frankly shocked at what he saw in terms of of humans. So I think that actually, in some level, maybe made it easier for him to see humans kind of evolving out of a lesser species, because he certainly thought these were lesser people. And then, of course, when he went to the Galapagos, he saw and was confronted with the notion that on different islands, animals like turtles had distinguishing characteristics, which must at some point have led him to believe to the realization that if you have geographic isolation, species could actually evolve somewhat differently. That would be a key point in his thinking.
And that's something that is generally acknowledged now, particularly as it's shown in the Galapagos Islands, which make up about a dozen or so islands right on the equator, 600 miles west of Ecuador.
Right, right, exactly. But, you know, while he was there, he, of course, he kept extensive journals, and he wrote down one or two interesting, intriguing little passages. He said something to the equivalent of, you know, you almost get a sense of the origin of life here. But it is clear he did not yet have the theory. It didn't come to him. In fact, he made a major blunder while he was in the Galapagos when he was collecting finches. He did not mark them separately by location. So he didn't know which island they had come from. He put them all together in one bag, and it would have really simplified his deductions later if he had kept them, the various specimens, isolated. So we know that he did not actually, the theory kind of came to him in bits and pieces over the years after he got back to England. It wasn't like a lightning bolt that suddenly struck him overnight.
It was about 22 years after he visited the Galapagos Islands before he wrote his or published his theory.
Yes, exactly. That's really one of the elements that prompted me to write an historical novel about him. There are three things that intrigued me. One, it did take him 22 years. He was like a world-class procrastinator, and he only did it after he got this letter out of the blue from a competitor, Alfred Russel Wallace, who came up with the exact same theory and wanted help in getting it published. That's what prompted Darwin to finally sit down and write. So he was delaying all this time, you know, spending 8 years studying barnacles and that kind of thing. And then there were two other things. He was a world-class hypochondriac after he got back to England. He suffered from unbelievable maladies, and the symptoms are so varied that no single illness can explain them. And thirdly, he really never traveled again. You know, this adventurer who at the age of 22 went around the world came back to England and basically never left England again. He took one trip to Wales. And so, you know, what could explain this kind of interesting array of eccentricities?
Well, looking at the theory of evolution, as he expressed it in The Origin of the Species, you speak of Alfred R. Wallace also having a similar theory.
Mm-hmm.
With the concept that the wheel was invented in several places at more or less the same time, do you know where Wallace got his theory, how it came in?
I know the lore of it, which seems to be the truth. Wallace, like Darwin, was influenced by Malthus's theory, which is, you know, that the human population would be exploding in numbers and out of control were it not for famine and war and poverty that kept down the numbers. They both had read this book and were influenced by that train of thinking. Secondly, and this was sort of surprising to me, the theory of evolution was very much in the air and had been before Darwin himself was even born. His grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, believed in evolution. That is to say, he believed that one species grew out of another, that it would, I guess, you look at humans, you look at chimps, you realize there are similarities, and so it's natural to assume maybe there was a common ancestor. But what Darwin did was to come up with a mechanism that could explain how it could happen, that is, natural selection. That was his great advance. And Wallace came up with the exact same idea in a bout of malarial fever. He was on the other side of the world in the Moluccas, doing some research, came down with malaria, was apparently lying in a thatched hut, and the theory just came to him like that, like a bolt out of the blue.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with John Darton from his home in New York City about his book, The Darwin Conspiracy, which I understand, John, is about 90% accurate and about 10% fiction.
I like to say that. That is to say, all the historical characters actually existed and for the most part did the actions they're shown as doing. But I took significant liberties in two areas. The book is really told on three different time levels. The modern day, where there's a young researcher looking into Darwin. Then in the 1860s, when Darwin is already an old man, he's already published Origin of Species. He's at his country estate called Downhouse. And then an earlier period when Darwin was on the Beagle. So I examine Darwin as an old man through the eyes of his daughter, one of his daughters named Lizzie. And she keeps a journal. And in the journal, she records her growing suspicions about her father based on all these eccentricities that she's observing. Well, I made up the journal, and in large part I made up Lizzie's character because she's not really well known to us. She's a kind of blank canvas, so I use that canvas to paint a portrait. And finally, I kind of changed an important fact on the Beagle itself. There was a member there of the crew named Robert McCormick, the ship's surgeon, and I make him... He was indeed very jealous of Darwin. He became a rival because he thought he should be the one to send back specimens to London. And I change his narrative. And I do all that. It's not an historical novel in that way. It's an ahistorical novel. I violate some of the precepts by actually changing facts around. And I do it, you know, for a higher good, I think.
You also talk about Charles Darwin having a secret life.
Up to a point, without destroying the suspense of the book, Darwin, we know he was plagued by illness, by procrastination, by his kind of phobia about appearing in public to defend his theory. And so I resolve all these various interesting threads in his personality by saying he feels guilty. He feels guilty for something. What is it that he could possibly feel guilty about? Well, an event happened during his five-year trip on the Beagle, a seminal event that accounts for where he actually got the theory, how the theory came to him, and why he should feel guilty about it, because, in effect, he expropriated it from the most unlikely quarter of all. That, I can't quite say, but the intent here, the real intent, is to kind of divorce Darwinism from Darwin the man. So I've changed Darwin's character. I made him darker than he really was, in all likelihood. I made him possessed by guilt, with a sense almost of original sin. And by divorcing Darwinism from Darwin, I want to really emphasize the simplicity and elegance of his theory, and to highlight, you know, the absurdity of creationism and its modern evil twin, intelligent design. So I do that. I change the narrative for an ulterior motive of actually dealing with Darwin's theory as much as with Darwin himself.
John Darton, I want you to explain the simplicity of Darwin's theory, but first I want to say that this is Radio Curious, and we're talking in this edition with John Darton, the author of The Darwin Conspiracy, a novel about the life of Charles Darwin. I'm Barry Vogel. John Darton, can you give us the Darwin theory that you describe as very simple?
I mean, basically, it is that creatures pass on characteristics to their offspring, which we all know. Occasionally, there are mutations. If these mutations are helpful or advantageous to survival, then those offspring will have a better chance of survival. If the mutations are negative, are harmful to the chances for survival, those offspring will die out. So that over time, over a long, long period of time, species will gradually evolve and change. And then if they're separated by, say, rivers or mountains or oceans, species that began that were once one species might even develop differently into different species. I mean, that's the theory in a nutshell. It's, when I say it's simple, I don't mean simple-minded. I mean it's elegant because it explains everything. So much so that Thomas Huxley, who was Darwin's great advocate and described himself as Darwin's bulldog, when he heard of the theory, he is said to have remarked, "How stupid of me not to have thought of it," because it's one of those great qualitative leaps ahead in which suddenly the world becomes understandable if you apply this basic theory of natural selection. He did not, of course, Darwin himself did not call it a theory of evolution. That word wasn't in common usage in its current sense back then. He called it theory of natural selection. And the famous slogan, survival of the fittest, was not his invention. It came from Herbert Spencer at the time. And Darwin was persuaded to use that instead of natural selection, to use the phrase survival of the fittest by Wallace, because it made it clear that it was a kind of random process. If you say natural selection, Darwin realized, well, you might imply there's a kind of entity out there that's doing the selecting. But if you say survival of the fittest, then you're shifting the emphasis, and you make it clear that it's really this sort of impersonal force that's acting, a selective force. There's not something doing the selecting. Darwin, you know, he did become progressively an atheist as he aged.
The view that can be seen on the Galapagos Islands now, which is the same as what Darwin saw about 175 years ago, basically the length of two human lives, is in the finches looking at the different islands and the different shapes, primarily of the beaks of the finches, which evolved to adapt to the food that was available.
Well, yeah, I understand, Barry, you were there.
So that's right.
You see, as soon as you arrive, you're struck by it's kind of like walking through a door to a different world, because all of the animals and birds act differently. They're not frightened of humans. They've never been hunted, and so they kind of exist, and you get the sense you're in primordial nature. And the beaks of the finches are actually very important in the scheme of things, because there has been a study beginning with two professors at Princeton, the Grants, in which they went to one island there and studied finches over years and years and years, recording various characteristics, including the size and shape of the beaks. And they were able to establish that when, for example, there is plentiful rainfall, the beaks in the ensuing generations are actually somewhat different. That is to say, They may be like a broader, like a kind of pair of pliers, or narrower, like a pair of kind of thin pliers to get at the seeds. And in times of drought, they have to be broader so they can crack a shell around a certain type of seed, and those are the birds that survive. When there's plentiful rain, they actually find nourishment more easily in a kind of little seed that can be extracted with the long, thin kind of wire head. Pincer-type beaks. So they can actually see evolution unfolding in direct response to the climactic conditions. It's a famous experiment, and I drew upon that kind of shamelessly, a book called Beak of the Finch, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, for the opening chapter of my novel, where the main character, Hugh, is involved in this study, and he's all alone on an island. So that kind of ties it together.
Well, John Darton, I want to ask about you. You're the son of a former New York Times reporter. You are a New York Times reporter and editor. You've lived in Lagos, Nairobi, Warsaw, Madrid, London, now New York City. How do you see being an editor when you editorialize in the things that you choose to write about, as I do, on selecting guests here for Radio Curious? What points do you seek to make when you editorialize by producing a work such as you have in The Darwin Conspiracy?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I've drawn a real distinction in my working life between fact and fiction. For 39 years, I've worked for the New York Times, beginning as a copy boy, then a local reporter, then a foreign correspondent, and then stints as an editor, both, you know, metro editor and news editor and culture editor. All that time, I was dedicated to, you know, I mean, I don't, it sounds corny, but a kind of search for truth. I mean, nothing but the facts. And I don't believe in a higher truth or a lower truth, just kind of the truth. And the more you deviate from the facts at hand, the more you deviate from the truth. That's on the one hand. Then I had a kind of a doctor, you know, that was my Dr. Jekyll. And then the Mr. Hyde in me, working at night and on weekends, would write fiction. And there I just let my imagination go. And it's fun to be to work in the exact opposite vein, that is to say, make up quotes, not looking back through your notebook carefully to make sure every word of the quote is accurate, and to just deal with themes that you can't otherwise deal with in daily journalism. So I keep that border between fact and fiction very, very secure. And someone, a writer called Stacy Schiff, wrote a piece last year saying the longest unprotected border in the world is not between Canada and the United States. It's between fact and fiction. And I believe that. We have to keep that border in mind so that we don't have these, you know, smugglers and traffickers crossing back and forth, reporters making up things and putting them in the newspaper, things like that, which, of course, destroy journalism very quickly.
When you go into the area of fiction and meld it with the facts as you have in The Darwin Conspiracy, it allows you to purvey or deliver an underlying message or theme.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, that's exactly the point of fiction. You know, it can start with an essential lie. And that's what transforms it from otherwise what might be just kind of journalism. In the case of the Darwin Conspiracy, you know, I was struck by the fact that in his day, Darwin confronted the same arguments that we're now hearing again today against evolution. And back then, there was an argument for so-called intelligent design, the same way there is today. Back then, the metaphor that was used was a watch. And there was a book by a man called Paley called Natural Theology, in which he advanced the argument as follows. If you're walking across a field and you come upon a watch, you pick it up, its beauty and its kind of the elegance of its functioning must make you think there is a watchmaker. And that was the total argument for the existence of God. And the same argument is used today, of course, by proponents of intelligent design. In fact, that's the entire argument. they changed the metaphor. If you came upon Mount Rushmore today and saw human figures carved in stone in an immense scale, you must assume there is a sculptor. So Darwin confronted these very same arguments. And what I've done in this case is to recreate, redo the narrative of his life to kind of emphasize the truth of his theory, you know, because I do believe his theory is true, as do, you know, most scientists who work with in the fields of biology and medicine and evolution.
And as you mentioned, you see this as a direct challenge to the concept of intelligent design.
I do. I mean, in a nutshell, there's a climactic scene in which there's an exchange of views between the civilized Englishman and an Indian tribe led by a shaman. And not to put too fine a point on it, but the lesson there is which side does the creation myth lie on? And if you just are an observer, a true observer of how nature functions, untrammeled by all the kind of baggage of Western thinking, you might come out with a very different conclusion.
John Darton, author of The Darwin Conspiracy, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes, I've been on a book tour, and a book tour means there are a certain number of nights in hotels in which you have nothing to do but see the town or read. So I picked up two books, and the one that I would recommend is a book by Orhem Pamuk, a Turkish writer called Snow. It's a novel, and I think it's absolutely wonderful. He uses new techniques of narration to draw you into the world, and you begin to understand the whole world of Islamic fundamentalism and kind of modern Turkey and the secularist kind of drive in Turkey and its pull between Western Europe and ancient Islam. And it's beautifully written with very strong characters. That was the book that stood out for me recently.
John Darton, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry. I enjoyed it.
John Darton is the author of The Darwin Conspiracy. The book he recommends is Snow by Orhem Pamuk. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.